Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Jason Heilman, filling in for Rich Fisher. My guest is composer and conductor Eric Whittaker. One of the most distinctive and popular composers on the contemporary classical music scene, Whittaker has written music in a variety of genres, from orchestral and band music to musical theater to film scores in collaboration with Hans Zimmer. But he's most renowned for his choral music, like Water Night, Sleep, and Lux Aurumque, which are all characterized by lush harmonies and a graceful, almost otherworldly lyricism. He's been artist-in-residence with the Los Angeles Master Chorale and was previously composer-in-residence at Cambridge University's Sidney Sussex College. In addition to his work as a composer, Whittaker is known for his four virtual choirs, which he assembled via the internet out of thousands of video submissions from singers around the world. The recipient of numerous awards and prizes, Whittaker won a Grammy in 2012 for his album Light and Gold with the Eric Whittaker Singers. This weekend, he'll be conducting the Tulsa Symphony and Tulsa Oratorio Chorus in a concert of his own compositions. That concert will be taking place this Saturday at 7:30 at the PAC's Chapman Hall. Today, Eric is our guest on Studio Tulsa. Eric Whittaker, thank you for joining us today on Studio Tulsa.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jason.
One of the things that really strikes me about your bio is you're not one of these composers who was trained from birth to be a classical musician.
No.
You had a more circuitous route to becoming that. How did you get into music?
I stumbled into classical music. Since I was a kid, I loved music, and I could play piano by ear, and I played trumpet in marching band, but was kicked out in high school, and mostly I played synthesizers in pop bands. This is the late 80s, and that's what I thought I was going to do. And then when I went to university, this is in Las Vegas, I grew up in Nevada, I joined the choir to meet girls, and the first piece we sang was the Requiem by Mozart, and it absolutely transformed me, changed my life. And because of that, then I started to learn to read music and started to study a little more formally, wrote my first pieces. I ended up doing my master's degree at the Juilliard School and woke up one day and I was a classical composer.
So when you went off to college, were you intending to major in music or did that just sort of come along the way?
It's, you know, looking back, I thought I'd be a pop musician. I was surprised to learn that there wasn't a pop music program. My other big love is physics and astrophysics. So I thought that maybe that's what I would end up doing. But yeah, classical music and choral music took hold.
So when did you start composing your own music?
In the third year of my seven-year undergraduate degree, I decided to write a small piece called Go, Lovely Rose for this director, David Weiler, who had asked me to come and sing in the choir.
A small choral piece then, yeah.
That's right, small piece for choir. And this man who had changed my life, totally transformed my life. So it started that way, just as a humble gift from a student to his mentor. And the piece, I remember very clearly reading through it the first time that it sounded like music, which was good. But more than that, it sounded like me, my true self, not Eric, but my true self. And I just had the bug after that. I just needed to compose.
And pretty quick after that was Water Night, one of your first big choral works.
Yeah, that's right. Also while I was an undergraduate. And Water Night was also written for a mentor of mine, a man named Bruce Mayhall. I had finished my seventh year, and I failed a voice jury that I was supposed to be singing on. I hadn't studied hard enough for it, and they told me that I was going to be held back another year, which means that I wouldn't be able to get my master's degree at the Juilliard School. So I dropped out, and this man, Bruce Mayhall, talked me into staying, one of those long four-hour lunches that turns the course of your life. And not only did I need to stay in school and finish, but that I needed to truly dedicate my life in a disciplined way to being an artist. And so I went home and opened this book of poetry by Octavio Paz. And reading the poem, I could hear the music in the words. It's never like that for me. Usually it takes me weeks or months to write a piece. And Water Night took me about 45 minutes to write.
Well, I'm actually going to be playing Water Night on my own show on KWTU in its choral version. Mm. But tomorrow you're going to be leading the Tulsa Symphony in a orchestral version of the piece. It's pretty durable. How did that come about? How did the orchestral version come about?
So the choral version was written right before I graduated and went to the Juilliard School. And then at Juilliard, they had a competition for students to write for the orchestra. And so I thought, I'll take my choral piece, Water Night, and transcribe it for string orchestra. And it didn't get chosen for the competition. And so it lay dormant for years and years. But now I can say that it's being performed by the Tulsa Symphony. Yes. So.
And the London Symphony was on your album.
That's right, with the LSO.
Yeah. Well, so you started out composing choral music, but you've also composed a lot of music, especially early on, for wind band and wind ensemble.
Yes.
And actually, one of those pieces is also going to be on this program on Saturday. How did you get into composing for band?
again, as an undergraduate, I was walking past one of the rehearsal rooms, and I could hear the band rehearsing in there. You know, you can hear it just as clearly through the door as you can in the room. And I walked in, and standing back behind the percussion, it was just the loudest music I'd ever heard. Seven percussionists and, I don't know, eight trumpets. And I think growing up with pop and rock roots, as much as I love music for choir and for singing, you don't feel it in the body the way you do with percussion. It felt like a rock concert, the way I felt it in my gut. And afterwards, I went up to the conductor and said, I've got this idea for a piece. I'd never written for instruments. I didn't know what I was doing. And he said, okay, if you write it for us, then we'll play it at this conference that we're doing next semester. So I wrote a little piece called Ghost Train for him. And it worked. And people started performing it. And I just stumbled headfirst into the world of writing for concert band also.
One of your next pieces for concert band was a little piece called Godzilla Eats Las Vegas.
Yes.
I think it's interesting for people who know your music and they think of your music as being sort of ethereal and otherworldly and not necessarily cinematic romps about giant lizards eating Liberace and Wayne Newton.
So having
firsthand experience with Las Vegas too, I think it makes it all the more personal for you probably. Tell us about Godzilla Eats Las Vegas.
Because I was in Vegas for 7 years doing my bachelor's degree, I had had it with Vegas by the time I finished. And so in my first year at the Juilliard School, I sat before the composition jury at the end of the semester, the end of the first semester, and they looked through the work that I'd been doing and then comment on it. And they told me that I'd been writing too much music for choir and that I should write some serious music, you know, maybe a quintet or a string quartet or a symphony. And I guess it was just an infantile response to authority. And so I had in mind this idea for a piece that would be like the soundtrack to a very bad, kitschy Godzilla movie. So I wrote a script as if there were going to be a movie and then scored the script. So there's no movie that exists now, just a very bad soundtrack.
And that piece has taken on a life of its own, become one of your popular pieces too, hasn't it?
Yeah, which I could never have imagined. I mean, I really thought, and now I've made this orchestral version. Mm-hmm. And so with the orchestra, it really does sound cinematic with the orchestra and choir. And I just have to laugh every time I perform, you know, that all these excellent musicians coming together on stage to make this ridiculous music.
Let's hear a little bit of Godzilla Eats Las Vegas just to tantalize the audience for tomorrow night's concert. Well, Eric, now having eaten Las Vegas, you went on to the Juilliard School, which is like the epicenter of, you know, starched collar music education in this country. How did you react to that? How did that work for you at Juilliard?
Juilliard was a great experience. I mean, I met some of my closest friends while I was there, and I learned a lot, especially from a single teacher, Mary Anthony Cox, who was the ear training and theory teacher. She really transformed the way that I looked and thought about music. I studied with a man named John Corleano, who was excellent, just an excellent composition teacher. And he guided me very gently into helping me find a sense of structure and architecture in the things that I was doing. The other part about Juilliard at the time, it was much more intense and stuffy than I was imagining. Mm-hmm. I suppose in my mind, Juilliard was going to be like the movie Fame, you know, everyone dancing on tables and super creative. Mm-hmm. And the truth is it's hyper-competitive, as you'd imagine. And so there's a nose to the grindstone sort of feel there.
A little bit like the movie Whiplash.
Like Whiplash, yeah. I would say, yeah, there are some parallels there. I think it's changed since I was there. I went and spoke there last year, and most of the students were smiling. So
it's always a good sign. So it's interesting to me that your early successes have been in music for choir and music for wind band. And those are the two types of ensembles that students start out learning in school, that kids get their formative experience in either a choir or a band. And then after Juilliard and you're getting your career started, you branch out into the virtual choirs, which I don't know if people know about, but you have conducted choirs of submissions via YouTube and assembled them into an entire piece. How did those, let's talk about those. How did those get started?
It was the craziest thing. So a young woman named Britlyn Losey, she was only 17 years old. She was from Long Island. She uploaded a video to YouTube singing the soprano line to a choral piece that I'd written called Sleep. And she didn't know me. She just put it up there as a fan, like an electronic message in a bottle, hoping it would somehow find its way to me. And a friend saw the video and sent me the link. And watching Britlyn's video, which is still on YouTube, I thought it was exquisite. Her voice was so pure and her intention was pure. And also it was very intimate seeing her face on the video there singing directly into the camera. And I had this idea while she was singing, if we could somehow get, say, 25 people doing what she's doing, singing their part, soprano, alto, tenor, or bass, they could be alone anywhere in the world, in their garage, in their dorm room, their living room. As long as they were singing at the same tempo and in the same key, if we just took all those videos and then started them at the same time, it would unfold like a choir, right? All the parts would just unfold magically. And so it began as a little experiment. Hey, gang, let's see if this will work. And then amazingly, not only did it work, but it was musical. So I had made a conductor's video that they were following on YouTube, and you can hear the push and the pull and the dynamics. And it started small, and then it went viral, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so far now, over the past 7 years, we've had over 20,000 singers from 110 countries join the virtual choir.
You've done four of those, is that right?
That's right, seven total.
Oh, seven,
four main ones, but we've also made one for Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And we did one for youth choirs, only 18 and under, for UNICEF and for the Commonwealth Games. And so it's one of these things that literally couldn't have existed 10 years ago because the technology didn't exist. And also that I just couldn't have imagined I would be a part of. I really thought it was just the smallest idea and it took hold.
What's amazing about them is that oftentimes when you're on the internet and really in our culture now, music has become something that you just passively sit and experience. And the internet is something you passively sit and scroll through. But you've used the internet to make music active and then make the internet active. And it's a much older theory of music. It's like when you would go buy your Mozart quartets on the way home and get three of your friends and play them together.
Yes, yes.
Is that something important to you?
I love that you say that way. Yes, so much so. And I guess it's part of my aesthetic. Mm-hmm. So I'm not such a fan of the typical proscenium concert experience, right, where the group's on stage playing and the audience is a passive listener to it. So even in a piece that we'll do on Sunday called Deep Field that I've written, the audience uses smartphones. They're playing an app that they're part of the piece itself. And so for me, always, I just want to use whatever props are on the table. In this case, the internet. Mm-hmm. So it's more kind of extending what the concept of a concert hall is and making music together than thinking of it as us and them.
Let's talk about that piece, Deep Field. That's one of your most recent pieces.
That's right.
Just a couple of years ago. How did that piece come? What's it about and how did it come about?
So I mentioned before physics and astrophysics, mm-hmm. especially. Since I've been a kid, I had a telescope. I've been a real space nerd. And I remember in 1995 when they made the Deep Field image. Many people may remember this. It's the Hubble telescope took an image of a completely dark area of the sky to Earthbound telescopes. There was nothing there. And then brought back this image that was 3,000 distant galaxies, some of them 11, 12 billion light years from Earth. To me, it's the most extraordinary image made by humans. It sums up, I think, how truly small we are and how impossibly vast the universe is. And so I always wanted to write a piece about that image and the way it made me feel and man's place and all of that. And it was sitting in a concert hall where they made the announcement before the concert started, make sure you've turned your cell phones off, right?
Yes.
And maybe again is this response to authority, but I'm always questioning it and say, why are we asking? Because really what you're asking the audience to do is to silence 2,000 video players, right? Mm-hmm. Phones just don't make sound, the video now. And I thought to myself, I wonder if there's a way to harness the power of 2,000 video players that everybody would show up with anyway. And then the idea of Deep Field that connected, and I thought, oh, this is a way to create the sense of wonder and awe that the image expresses.
So Deep Field is a piece for orchestra and choir. And then at the climax, you ask people to you know, turn on your app. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yes. Yeah. So they're waiting. Mm-hmm. I announce all this before the piece, yeah. right? But the audience is waiting with a little play button on their phone. And I say, just wait for that moment. And then towards the end of the piece, I turn around and give a cue. Everybody starts play at the same time. And what's beautiful about it, so on the screen is a fly through space and deep space, and then finally to the deep field image. But almost more importantly is that each phone is making this tiny little electronica sound, this shimmering electronica sound, which on its own is not that interesting. But when 2,000 phones all do it at the same time, you feel surrounded, submerged in this deep space feeling.
Now, you've conducted that piece at the BBC Proms when you had 6,000 people in the audience shimmering. Yeah. How was that? What was that experience like?
Otherworldly, truly. I mean, the Proms itself takes place in Royal Albert Hall, right? Which in itself, just standing on the stage, it's a singular experience for a classical musician. And then the lighting effects that they had in there, this kind of blue hue, you genuinely felt transported. It was one of the more memorable experiences of my musical life.
And it's interesting that now the audience is participating in electronic music, which is also one of those things that people often sit and watch. Somebody else has already sequenced
that. Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah. So if you want to participate in this, you're going to have to download the app. And so that's available.
That's right. So it's on iTunes or on the Android store. Mm-hmm. And I'll also make this announcement at the concert, the first half, so you can download it during intermission.
And yeah. I've actually downloaded it myself already. And I'd recommend people download it in advance so that they know that it has time, because who knows what happens when 1,800 people download the app at the same time. But also there's other videos and material on the app that they can get to know the piece in
advance.
Yeah,
and learn about the Hubble telescope itself and about NASA's, to me, it's one of the great human endeavors that the people at NASA, the great men and women at NASA, decided to do this thing, to send this thing to space. They built this thing. They sent it up there. It didn't work at first. This is partly what the piece is about, you know, is that there was an aberration on the mirror, and then they fixed it in space. You know, it's absolutely incredible to me. And then these images that came back are transcendent.
So the program on Saturday goes from the universe and entirety to something very intimate and personal. You have a piece of yours called Five Hebrew Love Songs on the program. Could you tell us about that piece?
Yeah, the Five Hebrew Love Songs were written. So I was a student at Juilliard, and I met a woman who is now my ex-wife, but we were married for 19 years. And we have a beautiful son together, a little 12-year-old boy. She's from Israel, so she wrote these gorgeous little Hebrew poems, and I set them to music. They were originally set just, she was a soprano, she would sing, I played piano, and a friend of ours would play violin, and I wrote them as little troubadour songs with the idea that we would be traveling through Europe singing for our supper at every place. And then I expanded them out for chorus and orchestra. That's what we'll do on Saturday.
Well, let's hear a snippet of that. Here's an excerpt from the Five Hebrew Love Songs by Eric Whitaker. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Our guest today is composer and conductor Eric Whitaker. He'll be leading the Tulsa Symphony and the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus this Saturday evening in a concert of his own music. I'm Jason Heilman, in for Rich Fisher. There's another piece on the program called Songs of Immortality. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Songs of Immortality. So it began, I was asked to write a piece for my 40th birthday. I'm 48 now. So for my 40th birthday. And of course, I thought, well, I'll write about immortality. And I'd chosen all these poems, you know, I'll live forever and do not go gentle into that good night. And then around the time that I began writing it, my father had to go in for a surgery, and the surgery didn't go well. And he came out with some really severe nerve damage, which he struggles with to this day. He's really my hero, how he's endured and found a way to find joy within what he's suffered through. And so then the piece became very much about that and about a different kind of immortality. And I chose two poems, one by Dylan Thomas, Lie Still, Sleep Be Calmed, and then a second poem by Emily Dickinson called After Great Pain. And so those pieces, also for me, are intensely personal in that they're very much about my father and my regard for him.
And another orchestral work on the concert is Equus. So yeah. This is kind of switching gears for you a little bit. A lot of this music has been still otherworldly. I mean, you know, apart from Godzilla Eating Las Vegas, which has a kind of otherworldly quality of its own.
Yeah.
So then Equus is a much more active, almost hyperactive kind of minimalist jaunt. What's that?
Yeah, so Equus is the Latin word for horse. And my idea was to write a moto perpetuo, right? So like a machine that starts and just doesn't stop, like a horse. And I guess it does sound cinematic. It also sounds a bit like a film score without a film. In my mind, there are just images of horses, you know, distant horses across a field and mist in a mythical kind of way, and then close-ups on the horse, and you can see the bone and the sinew and the frame of the horse moving, and all of it with this piece that just never stops. I should say, on a personal note, it's far and away the hardest piece I've ever conducted. It never occurred to me when I was composing it that I would have to one day actually conduct the thing. And I sweat bullets every time. It's it's a challenge.
So that's an interesting thing to bring up, is that you are, in addition to a composer, you are a conductor. How did you get into the conducting realm?
Well, I began, actually, the same man, David Weiler, who got me singing in choir, did summer stock musical theater every year on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And he invited me out when I was 22. He said, why don't you come out and be an assistant conductor? And at that time, I'd led maybe a couple of choral rehearsals. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about conducting or technique. And summer stock theater, you do 9 fully staged shows in 9 weeks, right? So you're doing West Side Story and Gilbert and Sullivan. And the learning curve, it's like jumping into the deep end of the swimming pool. There's just no time to not know how to do it. So you just do it. And I did that 6 summers in a row. And so just through dozens of musicals and operettas. And then during that time, I just started anybody who would let me. I'd stand in front of a choir, stand in front of a concert band, an orchestra, tried to watch great conductors steal and learn as much as I could. And they're still letting me do it. So,
and you'll be doing it tomorrow night here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's great. One of your recent singles is out, actually. So in addition to composing your own music, you sometimes arrange music for choir. And you have a single out on iTunes that is Trent Reznor's Hurt, now arranged for an a cappella chorus. What is it about Hurt that lends itself to a choir? That's, I think, my biggest question.
It's a good question. So it was written, like you say, Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, and that's how I first knew it back in the early 90s. And then it was covered by Johnny Cash.
Yeah, the big famous cover
right before he died. And it's just so haunting the way he sings it. And for me, when I'm writing music for choir, the alpha and the omega is always the poetry. It's the text. And so I remember loving the song, but reading the lyrics of Hurt stripped away from the pop setting, it's beautiful, delicate, tragic, layered poetry. And that was my way in, is reading the poetry, is treating it, I guess, with that kind of respect. And then my goal was to take that song that he had written and then elevate it. So you can take the formality of those of an a cappella group, and you can linger on moments, linger on words, highlight, illuminate certain things. So I guess that's what I was trying to do.
It hurts like a confessional, though. I mean, when you hear it, he's, you know, I hurt myself today, and it takes on a different quality when it's Trent Reznor or when it's Johnny Cash. But what is it like when it's a chorus then?
It's a great question. You're exactly right. It's a confessional. And then even more, it's a warning. Mm-hmm. So that he says in the hook, I will let you down. I will make you hurt. Like he lays out all of his flaws, and then he's warning whoever this listener is, just so you know, getting into this relationship with me, there's no way this ends well. It's tragically beautiful. And so somehow I think the choir singing that, it gives a humanity to it in a way, so that it's not so hard-edged. Like when Trent does it, it's very much a warning. It just pushes you away. When Johnny does it, you just hear regret. You know, you hear the years of the road in his voice. I think with the choir, what you hear is an inevitability of a basic human suffering. There's no way out of this, and so maybe an acceptance at the end of it.
Sort of the Greek chorus in a way.
Yeah, maybe a Greek chorus version, yeah.
You talk about lyrics. You've said a lot of music in foreign languages, in Spanish, in Latin.
Yeah.
And that's something I found interesting is sometimes you translate poems into Latin to set, like Lux Aurumque. Why Latin?
Why Latin?
Yeah.
You know, part of the reason I do it is that, let's take Lux Aurumque, which means light and gold, right? So the first word in the English poem, although the first sentence is light, warm and heavy as pure gold. That's the first sentence. Now, what the choir sings, the way it's set, is they sing Lux, and there's kind of a whole gesture, and then you do it again, Lux, Lux, Lux. Four times in a row, we hear the word Lux. If you speak English and you hear the word light, 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 the word machine in your brain can't help but try to add context to it, right? Mm-hmm. Light what? Is there a verb coming? Is there a noun? What is the? There's a sense of anticipation, forward motion. But in Latin, with Lux, I think it's close enough somehow in our the universal consciousness. We know that that means the concept of light. But because the word machine has been deactivated, we can just meditate on the essence of light in a way. So the sense of forward momentum stops, and we can just swim in those deep waters for a moment. I love that about Latin.
You don't think it's a little alienating, though, too? I mean, in a good way and a bad way. It divorces you from the everyday meaning of the language.
But in the best way, right? So for me, and maybe it's because I'm such a verbal person, I'm endlessly trying to quiet the word machine, the chatter that's going on all the time. And so I suppose in a way it's a very conscious meditation to try to find the part of my brain that is not speaking all the time.
Well, what better way to enjoy a conscious meditation than to hear your concert this Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center? Eric Whitaker, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Truly my honor. Thank you so much, Jason.
Composer Eric Whitaker is speaking with us today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be conducting the Tulsa Symphony and Tulsa Oratorio Chorus in a concert of his own music this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the PAC. For more information on that concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. If you'd like to hear more of Eric Whitaker's music, tune into my show, Classical Tulsa, today at noon on our sister station, KWTU 88.7. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We'll leave you with a little bit of Eric Whitaker's Water Night in his string orchestra arrangement. For Rich Fisher, I'm Jason Heilman. Thanks for listening.